Before we get to today's show, a special request to any of you who are American expats living overseas. We want to hear from you about what it's like to vote by mail from abroad. As the primaries and November 3rd draw near, what questions or worries do you have about getting your vote in the mail and getting it counted back in your home state? Email a voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name, your location, and we might contact you for a story. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. And thank you. Now here's today's show.
Today on The World, a warning from Belarus.
I'd like to say for all of those who are listening, don't let any bullies do their thing. Eventually, they will grow and it would be really hard to stop.
Protests against the country's president, Alexander Lukashenko, continue. I'm Carol Hills. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Sudan today.
The Trump administration is looking for some foreign policy wins, and I think it sees now Sudan as fitting kind of neatly into a broader narrative of Middle East peace.
And reuniting pets stranded by the pandemic with their humans.
They're part of your family. You're not just going to dump them.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We start the show in Sudan. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with the head of Sudan's ruling council in Khartoum today. Pompeo and Abdel Fattah al-Burhan took off their masks to pose for photos, but didn't take questions. The visit is part of a bid to normalize relations with Israel as Sudan transitions to democratic rule. Cameron Hudson is a former chief of staff to the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan. Cameron, the U.S. is trying to foster stronger ties between Sudan and Israel as the country shifts to civilian rule after decades under President Omar al-Bashir. But Sudan's government spokesman said the current transitional leaders have no mandate to normalize ties with Israel. What do you make of that statement?
Well, what I make is that there's some confusion within the Sudan transitional government right now. The State of Israel reached out early on in this year in February to military leaders, and the conversation between Sudan and Israel has largely been through security channels up to this point. Now that it's gotten, I think, a little more advanced, I think Secretary Pompeo is trying to move that conversation into a front channel diplomatic conversation. And I'm not quite sure that the civilian leaders in Sudan were as prepared as they needed to be to field this question about whether or not Sudan might establish normalized diplomatic relations with Israel.
One issue for Sudan is that it's on the U.S.'s list as a state sponsor of terror. And I know that Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok met with Pompeo to raise that issue. What does Sudan have to do to get off that list?
Well, there's a set of statutory requirements, which frankly Sudan has met or largely met to get off the list, namely that it renounce international terrorism and demonstrate that it hasn't supported international terrorism in the past 6 months. We have placed an additional requirement that they settle all terrorism-related lawsuits by U.S. citizens. And so it has been, for the past year or so, negotiating an out-of-court settlement with the victims of the USS Cole bombing and the victims of the U.S. embassy bombings, which Sudan was found culpable of in U.S. courts. There's a deal to be struck here, though. I think Sudan is very interested in getting off the terrorism list as quickly as it possibly can. It's running headlong into a U.S. election calendar right now, where I think the Trump administration is looking for some foreign policy wins that it can take forward into the election. And I think it sees now Sudan as fitting kind of neatly into a broader narrative of Middle East peace that it's trying to claim in the region.
You served at the U.S. mission in Sudan a decade ago when ex-President Omar al-Bashir was still in power. Have you been back since?
I have, yes. I was there during the revolution last year and since to meet with the transitional government and many of the people who brought the transitional government in. And it's a sea change. I mean, it's a complete 180. I mean, I think people walk the streets and you feel a sense of exuberance and optimism among the people, even though there's a punishing economic situation in the country right now. You know, things are not all fixed in Sudan. The government is having to undo 30 years of corruption and autocratic autocratic rule. So that takes time. But what has immediately moved in to fill that void, that vacuum, is a sense of optimism about the future, a sense that Sudan can rebuild, that it can turn the country around, and that all the sins of the past can be moved beyond.
Cameron Hudson is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center and former chief of staff to the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Republican National Convention kicked off last night in North Carolina. One speaker, Florida businessman Maximo Alvarez, was emotional as he connected his family's journey from Cuba to his support for President Trump.
President Trump, he's fighting the forces of anarchy and communism. And I know he will continue to do just that.
The Trump campaign wants to win over voters with ties to Cuba and Venezuela. First-time Latino voters have also been our focus this election season. Voters like Brian Guevara in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This summer, he told us politicians don't shape his opinions. For that, he goes to his mom.
She's the only influencer I ever had, to be honest. You know, I really don't look up to anybody else.
This week in our series, Every 30 Seconds, we hear from Guevara's mother, Nodia Mena, about her own political journey. Naomi Prilo from WUNC reports.
It is really, really, really messy, but I'm going to show you.
Nodia Mena shows off her garden. It's a hobby she's recently taken up. As soon as she opens the door, her dog, Neo, runs out.
Neo, you are so opportunist. So I have pepper, basil. I even have a tiny avocado there coming.
Mena, who's 48, says this is a rare moment for her. She's usually busy with her job as a Spanish language instructor at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. And when she's not teaching, she spends time watching political commentary on YouTube. Today, she's listening to a little bit of Trevor Noah before moving on to John Oliver.
First, I put Oliver, what's his name, the one on HBO? I have Trevor, Oliver, what's the name of the other guy? Steve, Cordell?
Oh, Stephen Colbert.
Stephen Colbert.
Mena is very involved in politics. It's a topic she discusses with her kids, like Brian, who will be voting for the first time this year.
She'll always have, you know, MSNBC or, you know, something on. And, you know, she's the type of person that always wants me to make up my own mind. You know, she never really told me, hey, Brian, you need to be a Democrat. She'll always just try to ask me my opinions on things so I could be informed.
Brian has used his mother's teaching to weigh his options for this year's presidential elections. That kind of guidance is very different from when Mena voted for the first time in Honduras, where she's from. That was nearly 30 years ago. She says she didn't take voting seriously then.
I voted for the least likely to win party because I just felt like it didn't matter who will win, you know? Like, we didn't count. Like, as a Garifuna, as a black woman in Latin America, my vote didn't matter. It didn't count at all.
Then she moved to New York. Mena says she still vividly remembers her first time being introduced to U.S. politics.
I was in the Bronx, and Bill Clinton came to Lehman College, and everybody was like, Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton. And I was like, okay, like, I had no idea. I came to the U.S. in 1991. This guy is running in 1992. I don't know anything about U.S. politics. But it was such a huge enthusiasm, and someone invited me to go around. We couldn't even get into the event. I mean, it was so many people, so many cars, and that was all new for me.
That image stuck with her. So she started to watch the news and follow certain candidates and their policies to see what it was all about. But Mena says she still didn't vote due to her own ignorance. That changed when she started working for the Barack Obama campaign years later.
I realized that during that time where I was going around canvassing, how misinformed people are as far as the reasons why we need to vote and how easy it is to influence people's view, not only about the candidates, but also about the party.
Mena says with Obama, she finally saw someone who not only looked like her, but connected with her. As an Afro-Latina, she says this is important to encourage voter enthusiasm.
I realized that we needed to, as Afro-descendants, we needed to get more involved in the decisions that were being made for us.
Mena says candidates usually try to reach out to one group or the other to secure that particular vote. But when you identify with more than one group, sometimes it can be an isolating experience.
It will matter to me if they reached out specifically to Afro-Latinas. But this is the thing, though. I don't think politicians should continue to think about people as this is Indian, this is Black, this is Latino. I think that this is the time where we should strive towards equity.
How candidates do voter outreach is part of the issue, but so is voter identity. For Afro-Latinos to stand in solidarity with African-Americans, Mena says both groups need to learn each other's history.
We have to start from there, because if I just come and say, okay, I am an Afro-Latina and I stand in solidarity with African-Americans, I don't think that there is enough information out there about Afro-Latinos for that connection to start automatically. We have to become more educated about each other's existence.
And she has that same belief for Latinos outside of the U.S.
In Latin America, let me start from Latin America, that solidarity is non-existent as far as the non-Black Latinos with the Black Latinos. As a matter of fact, when you say Latinos, it does not include me in that group. You have to specifically say Afro-Latinos. Why?
And that's not lost on her son, Brian, who is in school to become a teacher. He says more students need teachers of color to better connect with them. And Nodhi Amena thinks that kind of representation is necessary for future generations. For The World, I'm Naomi Prilo in North Carolina.
A huge ocean-going cargo ship loaded with oil got stuck on a coral reef off Mauritius last month. It's been leaking that oil, threatening the island nation's delicate ecosystem. But here's the good news. Oil recovery is well underway, thanks in part to the people on Mauritius who put together homemade oil-collecting booms soon after the ship began to leak. Vijay Naraido is the co-director of the Mauritius-based human rights organization DIMOI.
You know, as one people, as one nation, as we say in our national anthem, people were not requested. They didn't wait to be asked to intervene from the coastline, from the shoreline, from the coast where the trek occurred, and all inside the island, everywhere in the island, people started making booms, you know, from sugarcane straws and even from hair, but not to that extent.
Did you say that they were made of human hair?
Yes, actually. Human hair, placing the hair in the booms, because they say that air, you know, is a very good absorbent.
Wow.
Booms were made and transported to the place of the catastrophe and placed all along the shoreline. So that was fantastic. Huh? And the booms prepared by the people are, you know, they have absorbed to such an extent that now they have to be removed and to be replaced. And the replacement will be made by the authorities.
When this ship ran aground in late July, there was a lot of concern that there was going to be a massive oil spill and Mauritius was really in trouble. Are you much more optimistic at this point?
We are being realistic, you know. There are experts from Britain, there are experts from India, and they're all cleaning the sea, removing the oil. But special attention has to be given to the mangroves, because these are, you know, habitat for fish, habitat for crabs, habitat for seafood. So have to give attention to these. Fishermen, those who are active in the fishing activity, they tell you that it takes from 5 to 15 years before the environment comes back to its origin.
Can you see oil on the shoreline, on the beaches?
No, we can't see it with the naked eye. No. When tourists come to Mauritius, they wouldn't see oil or whatever grease on the beaches, no.
Vijay, are you personally worried about the long-term effects of this oil?
You know, we should be reasonable in the sense that the water was pristine. The water has, you know, oil has leaked into the water. Experts are doing their best. They have got their best, the newest technology. They have been demonstrating on television. We have seen how they are, you know, applying the technology to remove the oil from the surface and of the sea. And they say they are doing a very good work, so time will tell.
Vijay Naraidu is co-director of the Mauritius-based human rights organization, DIMOI. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, reuniting pets with their humans. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. The pandemic has separated families around the world as reduced flights and travel bans have made it nearly impossible for them to reunite. Well, there's another group that's been affected, pets separated from their humans. Our Shanghai correspondent Rebecca Canther spoke with two pet owners trying to bring their cats home.
Robin Schindel and her husband rescued their two cats, Gizmo and Gigi, from the Shanghai streets 12 years ago. They promised to give them a forever home.
They're always around needing attention, but also, you know, wanting a cuddle or a pat or food. They always want food.
The kitties lived a comfortable life with their owners. One is shy and the other is loud.
The one thing they have in common is that they both adore my husband. Even when the elevator door opens in the hall, somehow they know it's him and run to the door to greet him.
Everything changed this February when the Schindel family went to Canada on a vacation over the Chinese New Year break.
It was supposed to be a 2-week holiday. And then once we got here, really quickly, like our flights back were canceled and refunded. So we were stuck here.
Days of waiting turned to weeks and then months. Eventually, the Schindels made a tough decision. Friends helped them pack up their life in Shanghai and ship everything to Vancouver. But there was one thing they couldn't just pack up and send. Well, two things, actually. Gizmo and Gigi. According to a Reuters report, the Schindel cats are two of more than 1,000 pets stranded across the globe that owners are trying to retrieve. The situation is improving as airlines slowly increase flights and some nations reopen borders. But transporting pets during this time is still really challenging. Schindel is well aware of the restrictions and the exorbitant costs.
But at the same time, they're part of your family. You're not just going to dump them.
While the Schindels were in Canada pining for their cats in China, Fu Jingyi was in Shanghai pining for her cat in the U.S.
Beautiful.
She's a grad student there, and earlier this year brought a kitten named Cookie over from China. She expected to be in the U.S. for several years and wanted a companion. She says she's such a sweet-tempered cat and so cute. From the day she came home, she was friendly and easygoing. But in early June, amidst all the uncertainty of the pandemic and her housing situation, Fu made a split-second decision to return to Shanghai and find a job. Her parents paid more than $10,000 for her economy class ticket. But the only flight she could get didn't allow cats. She now pays for someone to take care of Cookie. She says, the hardest part is that everything costs so much. I'm under a lot of financial pressure now. It's going to cost me thousands of dollars to get her back. Fu is heartbroken as she considers her options. For now, she can only look at the videos her friend sends to her and wait for borders to reopen. She says, right now, I'm just going to wait and see. I don't want to just give her up. In June, it seemed the Schindels had found a way to get their cats back. Along with other expats locked out of China, they paid for a charter flight intended to transport more than 100 cats and dogs from Shanghai to North America. Let's just pause for a moment to imagine what that would have sounded like. Unfortunately, the plan fell through. But last week, after 7 months of separation, Gizmo and Gigi were able to catch a flight to Vancouver and reunite with the Schindels.
Hi, Gigi. Good girl.
Meanwhile, hundreds of other pets remain in limbo as their owners try to find a way to get them home.
Yeah.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
The Brazilian rainforest is losing trees fast. Many environmentalists and scientists say Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, is to blame for the rapid deforestation there. That's because Bolsonaro has loosened environmental law enforcement and encouraged development in the Amazon since he became president last year. Isabella Teixeira was Brazil's environment minister between 2010 and 2016, and she joins us now. Isabella Teixeira, in July, Brazil's National Institute for Space Research was reporting that about 7,000 fires were burning in the Amazon, many believed to be set intentionally to clear land for farming and development. How extensive is the damage?
Dry season in Amazonia comes after March and go along until October, November. Part of these fires based on the illegal deforestation.
actually, since Bolsonaro became president, deforestation is up about 30%. You're saying over the last 30 years or so, there were practices in place that helped curtail the illegal deforestation in the Amazon. And now those practices aren't being adhered to because of a sort of message from the top.
After 2006, we adopt public policy in Brazil, exactly to cut deforestation. And during my term as minister, you have the lowest rates of deforestation in the history in Amazonia. What you have to understand, it's the president gives the political guidelines. He has political messages that bring contradictions, and also he adopts public policies that went against what we had in the past to tackle deforestation. Big mistake from this government. Big mistake.
In fact, last year, you and seven other former environment ministers publicly denounced the Bolsonaro government, saying that they were systematically trying to destroy Brazil's environmental protection policies. Why did you write that letter?
We, as former ministers, we understood the new administration measures probably will raise deforestation. And exactly to say, we need to preserve Amazon. Amazon is an asset. It's very important for Brazilian society. And you know how to protect this. What's unbelievable is that we have the tools, we have the policy, we have the knowledge, we have society support. I confess, I don't understand why this government took the decision to have the setback.
You led Brazil's negotiating team at the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. How do you think the Bolsonaro government's environmental policy affects Brazil's international standing when it comes to climate and the environment?
This is a good question. Bolsonaro, he wants to go out of Paris Agreement, as Mr. Trump did. And we have a few reactions from Brazilian society and also private sector against this. And he gave up to have this decision. But what are the consequences? Brazil, you don't have a national strategy to tackle our carbon emissions. But Bolsonaro government go against the scientists, to go against the international multilateral system. And we are trying to manage how can Brazil we'll move on, consider climate change solutions. This is a lack of leadership, and also it has a high impact on the international climate governance.
Do you think what is happening in the Amazon rainforest will be able to be reversed with different leadership, or are parts of the Amazon being lost forever?
No, I think that we have all the conditions to reverse. As a Brazilian, I want to believe that we can move forward. So I hope that with the pressure from the society, I would like to believe, but we need to pay attention to the next 12 months and let's see what's happened. But unfortunately, we don't have transparency, we don't have partnership. We have a fragmented dialogue. It's like a puzzle that you bring different players, and this government doesn't like to dialogue with civil society.
Isabela Teixeira served as Brazil's environment minister under former President Dilma Rousseff. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
If you're looking for more ways to connect to the world, start your morning with an espresso shot of news stories from around the globe. Our team here at The World will get your day moving forward informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, delivered fresh to your email each weekday. Just head over to theworld.org/newsletters. In Canada, workers on the pandemic's front lines are being rewarded with permanent residency.
We really wanted to place an emphasis on the exceptional contributions of the asylum seekers who put themselves at the greatest risk.
And a controversy over monkeys and coconut milk. Those stories and more ahead on The World.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH and PRX. Today, Black immigrants make up a small but growing part of the U.S. population, coming from the Caribbean, Africa, and many other places. But when it comes to deportations from the U.S., they are especially at risk. And one group in particular, the Somali Bantu. They're a persecuted group that was resettled here 20 years ago. The World's Halima Gikandi brings us the story.
Omar Suber doesn't remember much about his early years as a refugee. The 25-year-old was born in Kenya, near the massive Dadaab refugee camp. His parents had escaped Somalia decades ago because of war and discrimination. They're members of the persecuted Somali Bantu.
If you look at me, you don't see me as a Somali. You don't look at me and see me as African-American or normal Black. You wouldn't guess I was a Somalian.
Some Somali Bantu were brought to Somalia as slaves from Tanzania and other parts of Africa.
I don't have the straight nose Somalis do. You can directly tell I'm not a Somalian. I have big nose, black. My hair is nappy. My hair is not curly. You can just see it.
They've been targeted and persecuted in part for it. Daniel Van Leeman is with Portland State University and has worked with Somali Bantu refugees.
The Somali Bantu, they were poor people, and so they can only flee to IDP camps and to refugee camps. And that's where I met them in 1992. And we worked with, when I was with the UN, I was a focal point on their resettlement.
Over the years, the U.S. has resettled thousands of Somali Bantus, with communities forming in places like Houston, San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Buffalo. Suber remembers the moment his family arrived in 2004. He was 9.
I was wondrous, you know. I was curious. Everything was curious to me. Cars, houses, elevators, you name it.
Suber's family eventually settled in Salt Lake City, and he started going to school.
It was a happiness I don't think I can ever get. It was like, I think that was the only moment of my life I can go back to say, I'm happy. I really like learning.
Next, his plan was to join the Marines. But then things began to spiral, he says. He started partying, smoking weed, and also struggled with his mental health.
I had some problems as I was growing up. From ages 12 and up, I started in therapy. I was diagnosed with PTSD.
Eventually, it led to trouble with the law and a felony conviction. Suber took a plea deal and did some jail time. He thought that was it, until Suber was picked up by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
I'm like, what? ICE? Who's that? I don't know whose ICE is. I have ICE at home in the fridge, but who's ICE? You know, it's like Immigration and Customs. Huh?
In 2018, Suber found himself on a plane being deported, not to Kenya, where he was born, but to Somalia, where his parents had fled, a place he had never stepped foot in.
It was a whole shock through the community. Everybody was just like, what? It was horrible. I don't wish upon it anybody.
Suber didn't realize he could be on ICE's radar. He was a legal U.S. resident. But his felony put him at risk for deportation. That's not surprising, says Alina Das. She's a law professor at New York University. She says Black immigrants in the United States are particularly at risk.
It's very clear that contact with the criminal legal system is a huge driver of this racially disproportionate outcome.
In other words, over-policing of Black communities trickles down to Black immigrants, who are then deported at a disproportionate rate, Dot says. When Suber was deported to Somalia in 2018, he remembers some irregularities.
Everybody had travel document, but I didn't. I didn't have no travel document, no papers, no clothes, no phone. And when I got off the plane, the officer was like, we don't even see your name here. What are you doing here? Who are you?
Suber stood out. He sounds like he's from the U.S., looks like he's from the U.S., and has tattoos, which could get you targeted as an outsider in Somalia. Being from the persecuted Somali Bantu group was another risk.
I was in the airport for 2 hours, nobody knowing what to do with me. Immigration officers in Somalia were like, we don't want you in our country. We really don't. We don't know who you are.
Days after arriving, Suber said he was kidnapped. He still doesn't know by whom.
They suspect that you have money. They take you as ransom. It happens all the time in Somalia. That's experience I cannot forget. That's something I cannot forget. I have a cut from the beatings I got from there under my eye.
He was able to flee to neighboring Kenya, but this is a nightmare scenario that the Somali Bantu community in the U.S. is becoming more aware of as news of deportation spreads. Dan Van Leeman at Portland State says the danger they can face is clear.
I've testified as an expert witness for other Somali Bantu young men facing deportation, and we've won on CAT, Convention Against Torture. We've won on CAT grounds to not send these people back.
Most Somali Bantu deportees I've interviewed have fled Somalia upon arrival, like Omar Suber, who hopes to return home to the U.S. His mother, Tahiro Ali, wants that too. I spoke with her from Utah while her other son translated.
She said it has affected the household a lot. And on top of that, she had so many miscarriages ever since he got deported because it just shocked her.
The family wants to reopen the criminal case that led to Suber's deportation. They think it was mishandled. For now, he's trying to survive in Kenya. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi.
Protesters in Belarus have been in the streets for more than 2 weeks now. People say the recent presidential vote was rigged, and they want their president of 26 years, Alexander Lukashenko, to go. The protests are unprecedented in Belarus and have been largely peaceful, but they've been met with police water cannons, tear gas, and stun guns. There have also been reports of mass detentions and even torture. We're joined now by two men who were recently detained on the streets in Belarus, Artur Raisky and Albert Kengerli. Let's start with you, Albert. Describe the day that you were detained. What happened?
Actually, I met with my friends, including Artur. The day we decided to grab drinks, we went out, and then, like, in a window of 30 seconds, we were detained for practically no reason.
So you two were detained together, Artur and Albert?
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
What did they say you both were charged with?
There was like two charges. First was hooliganism. So it's like we broke the civilian rule. We shouted. We were trying to harass the civilians with our, I don't know what. They were not very specific. And the second one was about disobeying the commands of the policemen.
Now, you say you both were then taken to separate places to be held and detained. Artur, what were the conditions where you were being held?
We sat in the camera for four persons, but there were eight of us.
When you say camera, you mean the room, the cell?
Yes, yes. We had a breakfast and that's it. It wasn't like restaurant food. We sat in the temporary prison during 12 hours without opportunity to sleep. There were rain, and we just walked under the rain during 3 hours. After that, we were moved to the prison.
How long were each of you held in custody? Let's start with you, Albert.
I was there for 6 days.
And how about Artur?
I was 3 days.
Were there a lot of other people who were detained when you were in the various places that you were held? Did you see lots of other people like you?
For me, I didn't see a lot of people because I had not any opportunity to walk out of my cell. So I understood how much there was detained people only after I left the jail.
We're speaking with Artur Raisky and Albert Kengerli, who were recently detained in Belarus. I'm wondering if either of you observed any kind of use of force or violence against citizens of Belarus, either on the street at the time you were detained or inside the prisons and jails that you were held in.
From my perspective, I had no idea about the scale of violence that were happening at this moment. At one point, I did something wrong, and one of the officers came up to me and shouted at me, and he hit my leg with a club. But I can't even call this beatings or violence or tortures. So I had no idea about what was happening at this moment in other places.
What did you think when you saw the images of the violence that was occurring against the people of Belarus? You say you didn't experience anything yourself or see anything, but what was your reaction when you found out what had happened?
I was shocked. Honestly, I cried for 2 days after I was detained when I saw these pictures.
And Albert, how about you?
The first moment I was really angry, but later it transferred to like unbearable sadness about all the things.
It's interesting. Both of you are witnessing an historic moment in your country, in Belarus. What would you like to see happen? Let's start with you, Artur.
The majority of people understood that this governance, the criminal situation during last 25 years, this country has no future with this governance. It was the final point when police killed some guys. So after that, the Belarusian society decided to change everything.
How about you, Albert? What would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see all this violence to stop because a lot of terrifying things are happening and it's really unbearable for a lot of people that I know. It's really traumatic events. There are a lot of people in this country that at this moment, they prefer not to agree about all these terrifying events that are happening. I'd like to see them waking up and understanding that the government does not equal the country.
Do you think that something's really going to change? Do you think that Belarus is on the brink of change?
I mentioned that it's not the time to think. This is the time to believe and to do.
I wonder if either of you have a message for those of us listening. What do you want people to know about what's going on in Belarus?
From my perspective, all of this story that is happening this year for 26 years, it's a story about a bully who was not stopped at the right moment. So I'd like to say for all of those who are listening, don't let any bullies do their thing, because eventually they will grow and it would be really hard to stop. So don't let the bullies be bullies and hope for the best.
We've been speaking with Artur Raisky and Albert Kengerli. They were both detained on the eve of the recent presidential elections in Belarus. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you, Carol.
Thanks a lot.
In Canada, like in the U.S., lots of healthcare workers on the front lines of this pandemic are immigrants. Many are asylum seekers, and now Canada is offering them permanent residency because of their work during the coronavirus pandemic. Emma Jacobs reports from Montreal.
Magdalena Jean-Pierre Michel arrived in Canada 2 years ago. She'd left Haiti after a former government official threatened her, she says. She went to the U.S. first, but believed it would be too tough to seek asylum there under the Trump administration. So, like many others in her situation, she walked across the border into Canada. In Quebec, she's worked as an aide in nursing homes while Canada takes up her asylum case.
J'aime mon travail comme préposé, j'aime ça, j'aime ça encore, parce que t'es proche de la personne, tu lui parles, écoute.
I love my work because you're close to the person, she explained back in June after a shift at a residence in Montreal. You talk with them. You're a bridge between the time they have left on this earth and beyond. Then, earlier this month, Canada announced a new plan for asylum seekers like Michelle, people working in institutions badly hit by the pandemic. They would have permission to stay in Canada, whether or not their asylum claim would have been accepted. Here's Canada's immigration minister, Marco Mendicino.
We really wanted to place an emphasis on the exceptional contributions of the asylum seekers who put themselves at the greatest risk.
Michelle quoted a proverb from Haiti. It means, she said, what's not good for you could be good for me. Which is to say, she explained, the pandemic is a tragedy, but it's also moving along certain things. In Canada, asylum seekers have received a mixed welcome. In Quebec, politician François Legault, who runs the province now, said around the time Michelle arrived that Quebec could not accept, quote, all the world's misery. However, Quebec's long-term care homes were critically short-staffed. Thousands of asylum seekers found work as orderlies, including Michelle, and were at the heart of a tragedy this spring as COVID-19 spread through hundreds of care homes, mostly in and around Montreal.
Ça allait vite, donc c'était comme un feu de forêt.
The virus traveled quickly, she says, like a forest fire. Some residences reported dozens of deaths. More than 60% of COVID-related deaths in Canada have been in Quebec, and 80% of those who died either lived or worked in nursing homes. Quebec's premier, François Legault, who'd once said Quebec couldn't accept all asylum seekers, soon began referring to care home workers as guardian angels. Still, he initially resisted calls from immigrants' rights advocates who argued that asylum seekers at care homes and hospitals should get papers to stay in Canada.
We cannot open the door to say, if you come illegally, if you find a job, that's okay. I will accept you as an immigrant.
Over time, Legault's tone softened, and now Quebec's government supports the federal plan to offer certain asylum seekers working in healthcare permanent residency. Not all are eligible, only those people who've been caring directly for patients. Magdalena Jean-Pierre Michel has mixed feelings. She is relieved to worry less about her status in Canada.
Je suis contente, oui.
After years of uncertainty, she can now stay. But she knows that some of her colleagues are disappointed.
Vous laissez les agents de sécurité qui m'ouvrent la porte.
Many people are not eligible for permanent residency, like the security guards who open the door for us, she says, the maintenance staff who help keep us protected, the kitchen staff. They were forgotten, she says. For The World,
I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
Everything is virtual these days, so it's probably not surprising to hear that the Indian Institute of Technology campus in Mumbai held its graduation ceremony on Sunday online. But this was not a run-of-the-mill Zoom call.
PhD degree recipients, please open the IIT Bombay Convocation 2020 app on your mobile now and play the animation.
The university created a 3D avatar for each student, and in an app, they could watch that avatar walk across a virtual stage to accept their diploma. Here's Deepank Verma, who just finished his PhD in urban science and engineering.
They actually asked us to provide our photographs, like the front-facing photograph and side-facing photograph, and also our height and also the body type.
Verma lives some 900 miles from the Mumbai campus, which effectively closed in March because of COVID. But he says the virtual convocation made him feel like he was back on campus.
It sort of gave us a feeling that even if we are far away, we are actually related to some group or some institution where people actually cared for us during this pandemic also, and they tried to do their best to actually invite us to the campus.
And, Verma adds, his avatar really did look like him. Well, except for one thing.
So in my photograph which I sent, it was... My hairs are like all around me, so my hairs are like more of a messy kind.
The school also set up a virtual environment, like a video game, where students could visit their old dorms and interact with fellow students. Verma says the whole thing was much better than he expected.
They could have given the normal certificates and said us goodbye, but they went a step ahead and tried to do something which we can actually remember for a long period of time. And so I think they have managed it pretty well.
Who knows? Maybe in the future, we'll be doing everything with virtual avatars. If you've consumed coconuts in any form, coconut milk, coconut water, coconut oil, there's a decent chance they came from Thailand. Thailand is a coconut powerhouse. It produces more than 1 million tons per year, most of it for export. Thai coconuts are known for being extra sweet and fragrant. But now the industry is reeling. That's because of reports that some of the hands plucking those coconuts from trees do not belong to humans. From Phetchaburi Province, Thailand, the world's Patrick Nguyen investigates.
I'm greeted by about a dozen monkeys. They're pig-tailed macaques from Thailand, and they look a bit like baboons. They're as big as a 4-year-old kid, but with much sharper teeth, so I'm grateful that they're behind a chain-link fence. They live at a refuge called Wildlife Friends Foundation Thailand. It's one of the larger animal rescue centers in Southeast Asia. And it's run by a Dutch guy who's lived here since the 80s. His name is Edwin Wieck, and he's got 300 macaques here.
Macaques are quite intelligent. They're survivors. They live in large groups. They communicate a lot. I would say that a macaque at least has the intelligence of a 2-year-old or 3-year-old child.
They're so smart that humans can put them to work, scampering up coconut trees that are 80 feet in the air. Very dangerous for a human. That's as tall as a 5-story building. But the monkeys can just climb way up there and twist a coconut until it plops to the jungle floor. And maybe that job doesn't sound so bad, but it can be a terrible life for a monkey. When they're not working, coconut farmers often keep the monkeys chained up, feeding them leftovers from dinner, and generally isolating them, which is bad for social creatures. All the macaques here at this refuge, Edwin says, used to have this job.
These are all coconut-picking monkeys. Nobody keeps these animals as pets. They're just not very nice pets. They're very aggressive. They're quite large, as you can see.
There's one monkey here that Edwin says is a bit different because he has all of his teeth. Farmers fear getting bitten, so they often pull out the monkey's super sharp canines with pliers.
His owner actually never had the guts to do it. And that was the reason why he was given up quite young, because he was getting too aggressive.
Do you have anything to add?
That's gone.
That was a stupid thing to do, wasn't it? Yep, he ripped the windscreen right off my microphone and chewed it to bits. Monkeys picking coconuts has been a thing for at least 100 years. But now it's become a scandal.
As you watch this, enslaved monkeys are suffering. This is the dark side of Thailand's coconut industry.
That's a recent video from PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The U.S.-based group says it went undercover at 8 farms in Thailand, capturing footage of macaques on leashes in tiny cages looking pretty miserable.
If you see a product made with Thai coconuts, such as coconut milk, oil, water, or yogurt, please leave it on the shelf to avoid supporting this life of misery.
This campaign is having an impact. Supermarkets in Europe and America have pulled Thai coconut products off their shelves. PETA claims that Thailand's entire coconut industry is tainted by, quote, enslavement of monkeys. But how accurate is this?
It is common used, but it's not widespread.
Edwin, the animal rescue guy, says there used to be many more monkeys in this trade. But these days, it's maybe 3,000 or less.
On the scale of things, the tons and tons of coconut products from Thailand being exported, that is a small part.
A small part. Now, one brand of coconut milk you might see at your grocery store is Chao Gok, which translates as island folks. The brand's parent company says PETA has hurt them bad, with sales down more than 20% compared to last year. But it says their supply chain is 100% monkey-free. They're even doing an audit with a French company to prove it. I called an assistant manager with Chao Gok, Bunchard Setawong, who oversees huge coconut plantations for the company. He says, yep, I'm out here at our farm in a province by the sea with the workers, human workers. Bunchard says, using monkeys on a big industrial scale, it just doesn't make any sense. They now have these genetically altered coconut trees that are only 20 feet tall, dwarf trees, and humans can reach these coconuts with a long bamboo pole with a blade at the end and just hack them down. In the time that it would take a monkey to twist off one coconut, he says, a human can get 10. Basically, human workers mean more profits. So when PETA says stuff like this...
An industry insider reported that it's rare to find a product from Thailand containing coconut that wasn't picked by monkeys.
That is just misleading. Here's Edwin Wiik once again.
I haven't seen any evidence that they got these monkeys in their supply chain. However, in my observation, the supply of coconuts is very uncontrolled.
Meaning, the way this could happen is a monkey picks a coconut on a small farm, the farm sells it to a trader who then sells it to a factory. It's possible, but not the norm. Still, because of this scandal, farmers who do still use monkeys, they don't want drama. Some want to get rid of their macaques. And in Buddhist Thailand, euthanizing them is illegal. So they're calling Edwin. That's Edwin and his team approaching two macaques. They're chained by the neck to a post on the side of a jungle road. And their only shelter is a rusty barrel. It is pretty bleak. These monkeys used to pick coconuts. Now their owners say, please, just take them. So Edwin's team sedates the monkeys, which draws a crowd of neighbors.
Everybody came to say goodbye to them, which is actually quite nice to see. Although people are a bit too close, I think, but she'll go down, he'll go down. Actually, even if he's not 100% down, I can take him now. There should be no problem.
Listen closely here. That's a monkey's steel chain being snapped off. Now, these animals won't be released into the wild. They would get torn to pieces. So Edwin's team will take care of them for up to 30 years. They live a long time. Meanwhile, the rescue center is swamped with requests. Farmers saying, take my monkeys, please. But it's more than they can handle. Edwin says PETA is talking about helping build more facilities for rescued macaques, which is great, but the help can't come fast enough. Edwin will take two today, but he can't rescue all of them.
This is two out of a waiting list of dozens of these kind of monkeys that we would like to but can't rescue.
In a way, the PETA campaign is working. Monkeys are getting liberated, if only there were enough places to put them. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Phet Buri Province, Thailand.
And that will do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.